We live in a rapidly changing world. From technology to globalization, our business world, home life, and environment seem to be thrown into a constant state of flux. How can we keep our world in balance? Welcome to The Science of Change with your hosts, Dr. Barbara Berry and Lise Inman. Our program will make sense of the massive change that continually seems to rule our lives. Now, here's Barbara and Lise.
Good morning and welcome to The Science of Change with Lise Inman and Barbara Berry. Within complexity science, there have been intrigue and exploration into the science of the brain and particularly the changing effects of meditation in the brain. Join us as we explore the scientific discoveries in neuroscience and the art and practice of meditation with Beth Field. Good morning, Beth, and welcome.
Good morning, Lise. Thank you very much.
You've been in this field since the early 80s and have had the pleasure of kind of following the progression of these scientific discoveries. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yes, I certainly can. Actually, the 1990s became known as the decade of the brain, and it was during that period when technological advances, including functional magnetic resonance imaging machines, which actually could take images of the brain as it was operating instead of static images of the brain, became available, which opened up a completely new scientific realm to be able to understand how our brains react to different kinds of input. And yeah, so that was the beginning of one of the profound benefits from that whole decade of research. During that time, a group of scientists who were closely associated with the Dalai Lama began to meet regularly to discuss the interface, or the possible interface, because they weren't sure that there was one, between contemplative practice or mind training and its effects on the brain. And so that work first began happening at the University of Wisconsin in the laboratory of a scientist named Dr. Richard Davidson. And what Dr. Davidson did was began to bring monks from India and Tibet who had thousands and thousands of hours of meditation practice, mind training, under their robes, so to speak, to observe how their brains functioned under certain conditions, comparing that to the brains of people who did not have that kind of training. So it was primarily through Ritchie's work that there's become this explosion of understanding that by training the brain, or the mind, training the mind, we can actually change the structure and function of the brain, observable now through the functional magnetic resonance imaging machines. That was nowhere on the boards, you know, when I began practicing meditation in 1987. We were working with the idea of improving our lives, but without having the congruent information from the scientific world.
There's a lot of scientific research showing the impact of meditation on personal well-being and as well as creativity at work.
Yes.
Innovation, which is so important to us right now.
Yeah, well, you know, when we talk about mindfulness or cultivating mindfulness or meditation, we're actually talking about change from the inside out, because the practice actually alters certain structures of the brain that can enhance both creativity and compassion, right? Making interrelationships more functional and more productive.
So in the discoveries with the Buddhist monks, what was the advantage that they saw in this changed mind or brain?
Well, there were several. One of the things, this is just, I'm just reporting the scientific data that I've been able to follow through following Richie's work. But apparently when the right frontal lobe is active, the person tends to experience more feelings of anxiety, of stress, of disconnection from their environment and their intimate people, depression, the kinds of qualities that we would say run to the more negative side. When the left frontal side of the brain is activated, no, I'm sorry, it's the other way around. When the left frontal side of the brain is activated are these negative conditions. When the right frontal lobe of the brain gets activated, comes more feelings of well-being, compassion, ease, creativity, openness, humor, laughter, right? And so after noticing that in the monks, they were able to actually shift the activity in their brain to the part that encourages the sense of well-being and ease and openness. As a result of their training, they could actually make that shift. It also has been demonstrated that the simple practice of focusing your attention on your breath increases a structure, the size and thickness of the structure in the brain called the insula, which is connected to feelings, again, of compassion and well-being. So simple practices, right, that, you know, not necessarily sitting on a cushion for thousands of hours, but simple practices like being able to hold your attention on your breath for, longer and longer periods of time actually begin to grow the part of your brain that helps you feel more ease, more compassion, more creativity. Pretty amazing findings, and all pretty much due to the total commitment of this cohort of scientists that have been working around the Dalai Lama since for about 16 or 17 years now.
When you talk about this ability to, in a way, embrace life in a different from a different perspective, can you talk a little bit about that in contrast to like the average person going through life? You talk some about how we process things through our senses and the impact of that on our behavior and the way we handle our stress and things like that.
Right. Well, if you know, the term that's all the rage right now in the scientific and psychological disciplines is mindfulness. Right, and mindfulness simply means paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. Right, so mindfulness, or this quality that we're talking about that is what's actually being studied, is simply a continuous non-judgmental accepting awareness of both our inner and outer world, right? And if we were to all stop, even at this moment, take a deep breath and consider the conditions of our lives, there are probably things that we're not fully accepting, probably things that we have judgment about, you know. And so the practice of mindfulness retrains the brain into being able to be with life as it is without reacting. And so to speak to your point about what causes the reactions, the Buddha actually taught this, and of course it has been further verified here through scientific research. When any kind of sensory input comes into us, whether it's something someone says to us, a thought can produce this, you know, something that we're not even conscious of, then the limbic system, which is below our level of consciousness, produces an evaluation of whatever that input is and sends neurochemicals immediately out into our bodies to tell us, you know, we should either fight or flee or move away from or sometimes collapse, you know, depending upon what the situation is. But what we're actually reacting to are the sensations that our limbic system creates by flooding our systems with a cascade of neurochemicals, all based on a judgment or evaluation that is usually made prior to our conscious awareness.
I think that's a really important point. And we're going to take a quick break and come back to that in just a moment.
You are tuned in to The Science of Change with Dr. Barbara Berry and Elise Inman. For more information about our program and the Berrywood Group, please visit our website at berrywood.com. Now, back to today's program.
Beth, you talked about this flooding of neurochemicals and the impact of that on your ability to, or the influence of that in making decisions on what to do at the moment. Can you talk about that a little further?
Well, yes, I can. You know, generally we believe what we think. That's the number one problem. And so when we have a reaction, right, we're usually not aware of that reaction until after we've already made all of the decisions, right? And so our frontal lobes kick in and say, okay, so since this is this and this is this and this is this, and all of those evaluations are made on past experience, right? They're very seldom made on just the, you know, what's in the moment. They're made according to past experience below the level of consciousness. And then suddenly we're making our decisions based upon our reactions to the neurochemicals that the subconscious has sent, right? And so the practice of mindfulness is actually to help us become aware of the sensations as they arise instead of just to react to them. So most of us in our daily lives are reacting, you know, when we say, you know, why did you do that? Well, I felt this way, right? I felt this way, right? Well, we feel these things and make our choices for how we behave, but if we can learn to observe the sensations themselves without reacting, then we have an opportunity, a pause or a breath, right, to determine what is appropriate reaction in this moment. Right. So we all get hooked into particular conversations, right, that are loaded with history, right? It can be, often it happens with our most intimate friends and partners, right, more so than, you know, and so the whatever it is, you know, the conversation comes, the thing is said that creates the reaction, and boom, you know, there's the barrier to further conversation. Nothing else can go beyond that. With the practice of mindfulness, if we, as we learn to observe our own sensations and be receptive to what is arising in us at any given moment, then we can pause before that moment of reactivity, right? And so sometimes it's great to just say, I'm feeling really reactive. Let me take a moment away, right? To just leave the topic and, you know, come to a more balanced place so the conversation can come not just from pure reactivity, but from considered reason.
That's very wise advice. And amazing. And I think there's a tremendous amount of training that goes into personal self-training, I suppose. Yes. That goes into being able to take that moment to think about your response, or take that private moment to acknowledge that you're right. Feeling reactive.
Yeah, it is, you know, we're turning not just the tide of our own personal experience, but we're turning the tide also of our evolutionary programming, you know, which has been fight, flight, and survival, you know, and at this point in our, in the existence of our species, it seems apparent that if we keep on with those kinds of reactions, they're going to be very dire consequences, right? So the very natural reactions that flourished our species at one time now seem to be the same things that are bringing disaster and could, you know, possibly greater and greater disaster on a wider and wider scale as we move into the period here where we have a chance, actually, through this combination of contemplative practice, science, and psychology, to begin to understand that there is another way. The way the Dalai Lama speaks of it is to cultivate positive emotions, because it's not possible to both hate and love in the same moment.
You were saying earlier about the emotions in the right frontal lobe, and one of the things that's always so inspirational to me when I see the Dalai Lama speaking is, and people asking questions, is he's laughing all the time.
Yeah,
that's just so inspiring to watch him. And
yes, and in the face of the great tragedies that he's, you know, he has been in, that he has observed, and he, you know, continues to have a role in. And despite holding that depth of tragedy, he is able to enjoy and hold with great compassion and love the people around him who are always continually inspired by his presence. And you know, one of the monks whose brains was the one of the first monk to have, you know, enter the scientific field and go into the fMRI machine, has now been given the title the world's happiest man. Right, his name is Matthew Ricard. He's a former neurochemist who became a monk and was one of the first monks who was willing to do the work in the fMRI machine. So we owe a great debt of gratitude to Mathieu for bringing forth his brain to let Dr. Richie Davidson observe the differences between his brain and those of people who have not been through some kind of mindfulness practice. And one of the interesting things, Barbara and Lise, is that these monks whose brains have been studied they've got thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of meditation. But there's also been extensive research done on with people who have done much shorter courses of mindfulness meditation, 6 to 8 weeks, and these same changes, not to the same degree, but these same changes are seen among that group of people as are found with the monks. So it's not, it is hard work. I always say it's the hardest work on the planet, but but results can be observed with actually not that long a period of practice and cultivating mindfulness. Some of the other scientific results that we found practicing mindfulness is that it actually enhances the immune system. So this is a really powerful finding, because almost every disease known to humankind begins with inflammation of some kind. And so mindfulness practice has been scientifically demonstrated to reduce our reaction to inflammation and enhance immunity.
That's fascinating. It really is truly fascinating. And I know that we've always had this sense that, our body is connected and treating the whole person is beneficial. I don't know that we've always had such powerful data to support the need for...
Exactly. And that's why, I'm thrilled to be, living in this time, because we have not, in the past, to tell someone that they should, meditate or practice mindfulness, it was as if we were asking them to, step off into some kind of spiritual or etheric field that didn't have any connection or grounding in, what we consider reality. And that's no longer the case. There are thousands and thousands of entries. If you, Google mindfulness, there are thousands and thousands of entries of, tests of studies and tests that have been done. And so this is actually the first time in all of history that we've had the scientific underpinning for exactly what the Buddha taught. And the Dalai Lama has gone to the extent of saying that if science can prove that anything about the Buddhist psychology, I guess we would call it, right? Because if science can disprove anything about Buddhist psychology, then it is Buddhism that has to change. So he has been profoundly instrumental in creating this interface between the scientists and the contemplative practitioners that now give us the scientific data that demonstrate, clearly that, this isn't, it's not just a good idea. This will change how your brain puts connections together. It generates new neurons. It increases the size and the structure of the hippocampus, which is where we hold memory, right? And we're still actually just at the beginning of all of these scientific researches. There are many more that are continuing.
Yes, and I think we'll probably see a lot more of it. Probably more the scientific. There's so much going on. There'll be greater discoveries at a quicker rate than what I think we've experienced in the past. Well, it's time for a break, and we'll continue back with Beth in just a moment.
You are tuned in to The Science of Change with Dr. Barbara Berry and Elise Inman. For more information about our program and the Berrywood Group, please visit our website at berrywood.com. Now, back to today's program.
Beth, anytime I've ever come across somebody who's had the practice of, who's been involved in the practice of meditation, they've had a calmness about them and a confidence about them, then that's really what intrigued me initially. Along with the ability, along with this kind of exploration from the systems community in using meditation to help better develop systems models that are more comprehensive. So, and I think you talked about it from the perspective of seeing the reality as the reality is.
Right. And I've been thinking, Lise, and trying to figure out, you know, how to hook this into a systems model. And, you know, one of the things I found most fascinating, there's a psychologist by the name of Daniel Siegel who took a poll of 80,000 mental health practitioners and asked them how many of them had ever been given a definition of or taken a class on the mind. And the response to that was 3-5%.
Oh, my.
So Daniel has come up with his own definition of the mind, which, you know, he says it stands because no one else has come up with a better one. And he says that the mind is actually a verb that is a regulatory process. The mind is a regulatory process that is both interpersonal and intrapersonal, right? So it's the mind is a process that's regulating information within us. And also, whenever we're in a group, the mind is regulating what's happening also among the group, right? So with mind training, right, done individually, we begin to regulate the flow of energy and information within ourselves. Right, but as we do that, it creates a tremendous potential, right, for working with others, as you know, working to control or to direct the flow of energy and information in a positive and beneficial way, you know, for an overall group or in an overall setting. So,
when we work we've found some really positive results of when we're working with in seminars or if we're working with think tanks to begin that each of those sessions with a short meditation process or grounding process, and
right.
Just really transform the results people get when they come then into the session to sit down and communicate together.
Right.
A higher level of consciousness and a higher level of conversation results from that. So,
and I think a higher level of being present.
That's it exactly, right? If we can be present to our own, you know, to what's happening for ourselves, then it's so much easier for us to be present with other people. And it's in that presence, right, in the moment, that actually the highest flow of creativity can come, right? And so those moments that you take, you know, to stop, you know, at the beginning to stop and help people come fully into the room and fully into their bodies gives them an opportunity to not do what the habit is, which is to kind of carry our whole lives around with us all the time without really even noticing it, right? And so to stop and observe what's happening in the moment creates a much broader moment that can be shared, you know, among everybody.
So, and I think that's really important because in the practice that I've done, which has been very short, I have been able to not in the moment, but over time, within the reactionary process, I've been able to stop and say, you know, is this really how I feel about it? You know, and a lot of times I notice that the emotion that when I evaluate the level of disappointment or the level of anxiety that I feel around it isn't even really relevant when I ask myself that question. And I'll just laugh because I'm like, okay, so why did I go there? You know?
Right. Well, this is the habit pattern of the mind. You know, this is what we do. And this is why the work of, you know, turning that ship in the ocean is not particularly easy. But again, Matthew Ricard described it so beautifully, you know, and your experience actually mirrors exactly what he was saying, which, you know, when he says that which observes anger, right, or that which observes frustration is not anger, right? It's not frustration. So it helps us disidentify a little bit, right? It's like instead of saying, oh, I am that anger, you know, it's like that which observes the anger, which apparently, you know, you're being just, you know, with a small amount of practice, you know, being able to have just that little window of opening to observe, oh, this is anger, right, then helps us not identify ourselves with it so deeply, and then yes, be able to let it go. Then have a choice. So, you know, this is not the reaction I would like. What would I like my reaction to be?
Yes, or what fits the reality that really exists?
Exactly. And
I think in systems, you know, all living systems have choice. And that's one of the kind of principles of a living system. And so when you think about it from that perspective, you say, do I choose to take that on or this emotion on or not? But that awareness that you talk about, that mindfulness that you talk about, that helps us evaluate that. It seems like probably, you know, generations before us may have had that skill and were much more connected to their feelings, their emotions, and evaluating those within the reality of the situation and through contemplation and reflection. And I don't know that, you know, we like to think of ourselves as this progressive society and everything, and I don't know that there isn't some, I guess, overvaluation of
the mind.
Technology.
Yes, and the mental processes.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and, you know, having watched this since I began my first meditative efforts in 1987, I just feel enormously grateful that certain traditions in the East have held these techniques very closely, you know. A few decades ago, it would have been almost impossible to find these teachings, to have access to these teachings. So at the same time that, you know, we see really desperate events occurring in the world, there's also a huge enthusiasm that I feel for, you know, seeing this knowledge come into our culture with this scientific underpinning in a way that is beginning to help more and more and more people.
Yes, and I think, as we said earlier, across more and more disciplines and more diverse industries.
Yes. Yes. The thing that you were talking about earlier, you know, just presence. There was a study done in which people who were in severe automobile accidents, were waiting for triage, and those who actually had someone with them with full presence, you know, while they were waiting, you know, to figure out which hospital they were going, but if there was someone who had someone with them with full presence, actually had higher recovery and survival rates than those who were by themselves without presence as they were waiting. So it's an indication that there's, you know, something very powerful in the ability to just be present in the moment with what is.
That's amazing. That just, in my mind, that goes to so many different possibilities that we're capable of, you know, if we can broaden our conversation to include, you know, this mindfulness.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break and come back to our final segment with Beth.
You are tuned in to The Science of Change with Dr. Barbara Berry and Lise Inman. For more information about our program and the Berrywood Group, please visit our website at berrywood.com. Now, back to today's program.
Beth, you've certainly intrigued us so far with all of this information regarding mindfulness. And if our listeners wanted to begin to investigate the possibility of exploring this themselves, can you talk about where they might get information on that and maybe some information on where this is taking place, where these studies are taking place?
Right. Well, the original program that introduced mindfulness to the medical community began in the late 1970s at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center with a man named Jon Kabat-Zinn. Jon is still deeply involved in all of these studies, and his program, which is called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, still operates at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, and Jon has been training teachers for decades now who offer mindfulness-based stress reduction. So that would be a good place to start. You can just Google University of Massachusetts Center for Mindfulness and get information there. I think they also have a list of teachers around the country who offer this particular kind of mindfulness.
Excuse me, I think you broke up there right after you told us about Googling the Center for Mindfulness. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, the Center for Mindfulness University of Massachusetts Center for Mindfulness is where you'll find information regarding the original program from which almost all of the research that we have about mindfulness has it has come from, and it also lists teachers that are trained in this technique in state, I think in every state in the country. So that would be a wonderful place to start. If you're wanting to, the Dalai Lama and the cohort of scientists around him have started an organization that they call Mind and Life. So if you go to mindandlife.org, you'll see some of the material from the conferences and events that they have had during the last 16 years, including one conference, which was conducted in 2008, actually at the Mayo Clinic. So that's a strong indication of how deeply this model is now moving into conventional medical care. Mayo Clinic doesn't invite just anyone to come and do their conference there. So, and there's also lots of interesting information if you go to, if you Google Richie Davidson, RichieDavidson. Richie is continuing some amazing studies in his laboratory at the University of Wisconsin. It's called the University of Wisconsin Weizmann Center, the Lab for Effective Neuroscience. He's doing some amazing studies and ongoing studies where people can get some really hard science about a variety of different conditions that meditation and mindfulness can treat. And, you know, the important thing, too, though, Lisa and Barbara, that I think it's for, is for people to understand is that, you know, to undertake a practice like this is like, you know, kind of taking a little turn away from the flow of life just pushing us along. And that can be very difficult. But the results can come quite quickly. You know, I haven't had a single student who hasn't had observable results of some kind, even if they weren't practicing diligently, right, within a matter of 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. So there's tremendous potential and, so much that's still being learned, but so much that now has the underpinning of rigorous scientific investigation to convince us, right, to help convince our minds that this is not just a good thing to do. It has specific and clear scientific results.
Yes, and I think, as you were saying, that my experience is most of the major medical clinics in the U.S. and probably across the world are now integrating mindfulness into their treatments.
Yes, there's now mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and mindfulness-based addiction relapse therapy, and there's just become a whole host of ways that the different disciplines of psychology and science are beginning to integrate mindfulness into their disciplines as well. And I think we'll just be seeing nothing but more of this as time goes on.
I think one of the things that makes that opens young people to the idea, some of the young people I've worked with, is the relationship with mindfulness or meditation and athletics and the flow of their performance.
It affects every part of our lives in very beneficial ways. Yeah. And I think it feels like it might cutting out here, but you know, people who enter for any particular reason might also find, you know, a whole host, you know, a whole new universe opening in terms of what mindfulness practice can bring to personal relationships, to work relationships, to all kinds of, you know, all of our endeavors. And to do it with a sense of ease and lack of judgment. Doesn't that sound like a wonderful idea?
It does. It does sound like a wonderful idea. So the relationship, I think as we become more and more, as our lives become more busy and hectic, and we thought technology was going to make our lives easier, but in fact, it's my experience, it makes it much more stressful if you let it get a hold of you. And so I think there's a serious demand now for us to pay attention to this ability to reduce our stress. And how else are we going to be calm with all the change that's going on around us?
Right. And you use the key word, right? Pay attention, right? But in a particular way, right? Pay, John Kabat-Zinn, back to his original definition, paying attention in a particular way in the present moment with no judgment. Takes a lot of work.
It does take a lot of work.
Well worth it.
Yes, and I think approaching it not as a guilt for not being able to practice regularly is...
Right. Oh, exactly.
It's part of the judgment.
Right. That's part of letting things, yeah, accepting things as they are. Absolutely. You know, and yet it is in the practice that we begin to get the real results.
So that brings us to the end of our show. And Beth, we want to express our gratitude for you to bring us this wonderful message. And we hope to hear from you again.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you for tuning in to The Science of Change with your hosts, Dr. Barbara Berry and Lise Inman. Please tune in again next Thursday morning at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Remember, change is a good thing. How we perceive it can be better.